We good to go? Okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for coming out. Today's event will be recorded. So just to let you know, mostly for people who couldn't make it. Thank you for coming out. This is the first of a series of fall programs from the Library Forum on Get to Know Your AULs. And today we have Sheen Lee, and I'm going to get this right, Associate University Librarian for Central Library Operations, and John Saylor, Associate University Librarian for Scholarly Resources and Special Collections. Later in November, on November 5th, in this very room at 1 o'clock, we will have Oya Rieger and Dean Kraft in session two, and then rounding out the fall series on December 5th, also here in 160, from 2 to 3:30 will be Janet McHugh and members of the Library Director's Leadership Team. So the way this is going to work, I'm going to turn it over to John and Sheen, and they figured out who's going to go first. They're going to give a little background presentation on themselves, and then we'll open it up to questions. And I have some questions that were sent in ahead of time, and I'll go from there, and I'll also turn it over to all of you to ask questions. Because we're recording, we do have a microphone that we're going to hand around to all of you to ask your question. You will not become the voice of God. It's not going through the PA system. It will actually just go to Matt, who is in fact God, at least as far as that is concerned. So anything you say will be recorded, just to let you know. Ahead of time, and this will be preserved for posterity, as they say. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over. Did you guys thumb wrestle to figure out who was going to go? John lost. Okay, so he's going to go first.
Okay, so I have a small PowerPoint. My understanding is that we each have about 10 minutes to tell you a little bit about ourselves and about our domains, how we all work together. So I guess I minimize this. I'm a Mac user, and I'm going to start out with something different than my first slide. Since we're supposed to tell you a little bit about us, this is me in the beginning. And about 17 years later, I turned into this. So this was in high school, and I was captain of the football team then, but. So that follows my trajectory as followed along that line. And then this is me in 1968 at the University of Pennsylvania. So I won't bore you with any more of that.
Did you guys beat Cornell?
Yeah. Actually, I did this finger on where the entomology library is now. I broke this finger there.
That's where you played?
Yeah.
That's where they used to. Okay.
It was, I played 150-pound football. I didn't play varsity, so. Anyway, so I'm the Associate University Librarian for Scholarly Resources and Special Collections, and you saw the org chart of the whole library. This basically is my org chart. Actually, I have to go a little further forward, sorry. This is my org chart with the people that report to me highlighted in red. So I have Kaiser Walker, who's the Director of Collection Development, among many other things. And Rich Entlich is our collection analyst. And Elaine Inks is the Director of the Division of Rare and Manuscript Collections and the University Archives. And then the Asia Collections curators report to me as well. And then you'll see in the two blue boxes something sort of unique here at Cornell are the Too Cool subject curators. There's Rob Davis, who is responsible for Slavic and Eastern European studies, and Sean Knowlton, our new Latin American studies librarian. So this is the group that is primarily responsible to me. But one thing I want to emphasize, and I think Sheen will too, is that everything we do is with teams. Everything we do is with collaboration. And it's there's nothing, really nothing that's done alone in anything we do. So I was thinking about, what are the main things that I'm responsible for, or I have some kind of partial responsibility for. The first being planning and for scholarly resources. I think our division is a major liaison between the collection itself and the faculty and the library executive group. So I represent the collection and faculty and students on the library executive team. I'm also involved with the several priority objectives. One is the item 1.1, which deals with fundraising. One of my major responsibilities is the materials budget allocation. So I have about $10 million that I allocate to about 40 different people. And I allocate this, again, you know, in collaboration with Kaiser and with the Collection Development Executive Committee. So it's not anything I really do alone, but I have the ultimate responsibility for it. Our group is also responsible for coordination of selector activity, although very few of the selectors report to me or report to my division. Kaiser does, the Asia selector does, and the RMC selectors do, but outside of that, everybody else reports to somebody else. So there's a lot of coordination and working together across divisions or across lines. That's true in terms of policies and new initiatives such as the web archiving, which will have selection responsibilities. Right now it has mostly responsibilities in RMC, but we're looking at hopefully some cataloging help to be the person who actually does the crawls and then open it up to more general selection for that. I work with people in Sheen's unit on vendor relationships and negotiations and licensing. Another major aspect of which is also system-wide is collection analysis, Rich Entlich. And then I have the administrative oversight, not the expertise, in the Asia collections and special collections. It's not my background. My background is in engineering and computer science. So, and then I also have activity in scholarly communications. In other words, I manage the Cornell Open Access Publication Funds. I work with OYA and Kaiser and other colleagues on scholarly communications issues. And then a very major part of my work for the past number of years has been cooperative collection development partnerships. And that's another priority objective that I lead. And then last but not least are external groups that I'm involved with. CCDO is the Chief Collection Development Officers of the large ARLs. The BorrowDirect AULs, the Center for Research Libraries, the New York State Higher Education Initiative, and things like that. So I guess that's about my introduction. And we'll save questions till.
Do we do questions last?
Why don't we let Sheen go, and then we'll open it up to questions. Okay. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Good morning. I certainly didn't talk to John, so I didn't know he is going to bring baby pictures. I don't have any. And what I will do, I have four slides, basically no organizational charts, but to talk about the functions I supervise in the library and tell a little bit, give you specific cases, what I do, how we work, and what the challenges are. So, since I don't have baby pictures, I can tell you, I have been at Cornell, I was telling Sally, now 10 years. I couldn't believe it has been 10 years. I have two children, 12 and 15. Right now, I'm an interim single mother because my husband works in Taiwan still. So I juggle between life and work and so on. That may impact some of the questions I ask and answer. So I'm the AOL for Central Library Operations. I hate that title because it doesn't tell anything because people don't know what Central Library Operation means. And therefore, I figured everyone has to have a title, you know, any organization. Therefore, I might as well talk about the functions. As John mentioned, I do nothing alone. I work with many, many people. And in the organizational structure, Jim LeBlanc reports to me, and Julia Cote reports to me. And I also have a role that no one reports to me, but I work with many people, which I will touch upon too. I oversee technical services. To me, technical services is the engine, keeps the engine running of the library. Why do I say that? If the technical services does not buy, does not license, does not catalog, does not make the things ready, the library come to a halt because there's nothing to be accessed. And this is why I think technical services runs the engine of the library. And the challenge of managing technical services is to users, they transform without knowing. Technical services has to squad between the traditional book, paper, object-based use, while also handle the rapid growth of digital, live streaming, metadata, data, and everything. But to the users and to the other functions of the library, the technical services, what they do has to be predictable. You kind of know what they do every day, what is there, how the workflow is done. And then they feel there is a certain stability in the whole operation. But it has to be enduring as well, meaning enduring how you transition. It shouldn't be disruptive to the users. You just do it yourself. So to me, it is not an easy job, because all of you know what has changed. And the 5 years ago, let's not even mention 10 years ago when I first joined technical services as the acquisitions head. And this is where, in my heart, I feel technical service will exist as long as library exists. And then, if I find the button, I separate assessment and communication because it is slightly different functions, although both functions are directed by Zhuja. Assessment to me is far beyond number collecting, statistic reporting, although in many instances people think, that's what we do, annual reports and so on. I wanted to illustrate what it does, and good assessment really illuminates decision making of the library. Many things assessment staff does is not necessarily known to even the COL staff. For instance, in 2008, when Sarah Thomas left, how we reorganized was based on a lot of data that assessment unit staff collected. How Managers Council is established is based on the data. How we did a lot of things is based on the climate goal. And we did a lot of tons and tons of user services, including what should be displayed on the digital sign, came from data that the assessment staff did. So what the true value is to really help decision making better. The challenge is there's no clean cut. No data is perfect because we don't have the controlled environment. When you say, what is collection? Are we doing good collection development? It's an unanswerable question. So you can only have a times, kind of a snapshot of a particular time to say usage. And oftentimes when the decision comes, the provost may ask Zhuja, Professor so-and-so said, we are falling behind. And we started immediately digging. But it's very hard to decipher how much is good enough. And my role working with Zhuja oftentimes is to say, I believe this is good enough. And I work with Zhuja, I work with Jim to be their supporters, advocates, and whenever they need help, when they need ways paved, when they cannot, that's where I come in. Communication. This is what I got last week. I went to the Student Library Advisory Council and asked 35 students two questions. What kind of information do you care to receive from the library? And how do we deliver these information to you without turning you off? This is one of the things I received. So they talked, I had 20 minutes. Many people talked about how they wanted to be, but I said certain people may not get to talk, or certain people may not want to talk. Write it down and send me the paper. They say, I don't like email anymore. I don't even read department emails. I don't look at bulletin board. I don't take elevators. I want it on Facebook. I want it blah. So this is the kind of thing that is not just help communication. It helps decision making. So what I do, I share with Jason for a library outside of library. I shared with some unit librarians. I share, of course, with communication department. I shared with Kathy Chan and Dan because they lead the outreach function. And I was lucky, it happens to be Kaiser let me to have like 20 minutes or 15 minutes on the CD exact. They happen to talk about outreach. This should influence how we outreach. And this is the kind of thing. But the dreadful part, I always have to talk about the challenge part of communication, is it's very behavior sensitive. A year ago, when we asked the student, can we appear on your Facebook? No, it's where I social, don't come near me. Now look, prefer, it has changed. How many of us use iPhone? How many students use iPhone? It's very consumer technology driven. So it's very sensitive towards what's happening outside of library. And it's very opportunistic. And there are times communication has its day planned out. Sun comes up with an article. It says something wrong, says something not completely true. It has to be addressed that day. So, or somebody said something we thought, oh, we have that treasure. Let's make a big deal out of it. That's what I mean. That's the life of communications. You really have very little control over your day. And compared to other functions I supervise, communication is the least error tolerant. You know the viral media. When something is said wrong about the library, it goes poof out there. You have to control damage right then and right there without getting on people's nerves, because they don't want to hear corrections. And how do you deal with that? That's the life of communication. So again, I work with the wonderful staff. We talk about strategies, and I can give you a very specific example. This year, the Sun sent a special piece to all freshmen, used the library information from 2009. All freshmen received it. It talks about engineering library and so on. That is wrong. But there's nothing for Gwen or Shusha or Carla to correct, because it was sent to the students. It does not appear anywhere. What do you do? This is the type of life that communication has. And we sit down and think about how to get a hold, how to get attention of the Sun editor. Sun prides itself for independence. And what do you do when the students are going to a place that has been closed? So this is the kind of thing we do. And lastly, this is the maybe the only thing I do alone. I speak Chinese. So I have been doing the partnerships in East Asia since 2005. The reason it does not appear on the org chart is because I supervise no one. My job in this particular case is talk to different selectors, unit libraries, to find out how to extend content or expertise when our own are no longer enough. For instance, Mary Oaks and Marty Schlabach tell me it would be wonderful if we could get access to rare entomology collections, because a lot of bugs, I know nothing about bugs, migrate from one continent to the other. A lot of rare books have illustrations. Therefore, the language barrier matters less. So I keep in mind. Bana tells me, Xing, it would be nice if you find out who are the contemporary composers in China, Taiwan, and Japan that we should collect. I find out, and I give her a list. And now I have a to-do list that I haven't gotten very far, which is from Curtis, who tells me, we have a wonderful labor movement collection, but it's very North America-centric. How about going to the countries where labor movement is a big deal, but it is politically very difficult to do? But I keep it in my mind, so when I build relationships in China, I try to find out who has it, what they have, whether it's in, you know, object form, are they going to plan to digitize it? If they do, are they willing to share? If they don't plan to digitize, it is closed. Can we please have a relationship that when our users go there, we have on-site access? So this is the type of thing. So the challenge is, sometimes I'm thinking, oh my God, how am I going to write my performance report at the year end, because all I did was drinking tea with people. Because I'm cultivating trust, and it doesn't have immediate outcome that I can describe, because it's a very noisy, everybody wants this, and we are there, and my first and foremost thing is to make Cornell come to mind with a visibility, with a brand, with stuff that people say, if I'm going to partner, I'm going to partner with Cornell, and for that I drink tea and I worry about my performance evaluation at the year end. It's very culture sensitive, and I'm Asian. I grew up and went to college in China, and then I spent 2 years in Germany. I speak German because that was my major, and I know how to build trust, and how I know good enough about all of the aspects. I work with all AULs so that I could be culture sensitive as I build up that relationship. And it's really iterative. By that, I don't want to use the word slow, because some could be very fast, some could be very slow. So that's about what I wanted to talk about. All of the partnerships, all of the things we have access to are on the staff web. I don't want to claim credit for me alone, because I work with Liren, I work with subject specialists, I work with John, I work with Janet, and all of my colleagues. So that's what I do.
Well, thank you, Sheen and John. So we're going to ask you guys to come over front and center. And we have the, so Wendy or Sally, could you take the mic from Matt? I'm going to start it off with one of the questions we received through our anonymous Dropbox, and then I'll turn it over to see if there are questions that any of you have. So the first question for our contestants: what kind of things do you look forward to in your workday?
Want to go?
We saw these questions before, so.
We're very honest.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing I look forward to is just working with all the people I know, you know, and sometimes getting something done, or feeling like I've helped accomplish something. That's what I enjoy the most.
I too, and I said this many times. In my heart, I'm a people person. I can do other jobs or work in companies. I can't leave the people here. I look forward to coming to, into my groups or running to people and ask things and hear wonderful things, and sitting next to Jesse, who after he's heard something and wrote on the paper to say, we can probably tweet about this. Those are the things I look forward to, working with people.
Okay, so far so good. Who in the audience has a question for John and Sheen? Okay, then we're going to go back here to our list of questions. What gives you the greatest sense of accomplishment in your job as AUL?
I'll go first, I guess. As I said, I don't do anything alone other than speaking Chinese, maybe. For me, we have so much to do. What gives me really good sense of accomplishment is, in my role, if I give either the project team or my staff very clear directions, I could articulate what the direction is, while also had enough opportunity for everyone to put into this kind of decision, gives me a sense of accomplishment. I think a person like an AOL could do a lot of damage if the direction is very vague. If if there are tough decisions that the staff may not agree, if I couldn't convince them or couldn't have hear them enough, then I failed in my job. So for me, that is very important.
Yeah, for me, there's a vast number of many small things, and then a bunch of big things that come along on a yearly basis. I mean, the small things might be, I got a question from Ed Weissman to respond to a graduate student about in history who's heard that we are not buying books anymore in favor of e-books, and why are we doing that? And so I get together with Kaiser. We come up with a response. Kaiser's expertise is in humanities, and I really rely on that. My background's in, as I said, in the sciences. And write this draft letter back to Ed, and Ed says, this is great. So that's a real sense of accomplishment. In terms of big things, we have the yearly budget, materials budget allocation process. And that's a multi-month process that I work on with 40-some people. And having that come out and to have most people be satisfied with it, especially during the last couple of years of budget cuts, as it's it's been satisfying to me that we move forward, and it's satisfying now to be getting some more money to do the things we need to do with.
Mm-hmm. There's one thing that John and I may not even mention because it's given. I think it's for us, we know the weight we carry, we know the importance and the big responsibilities we have. We would feel a sense of accomplishment if all of our own staff are taken care of, meaning, we did our best to hear the voice, to provide what we can support, and to feel that our staff have a very adequate level of job satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes we don't mention that because it's like part of us. So would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Question?
We have a question.
Such a short question. Do I really have to wait for Mike?
We'll let Steve go, and then we'll go to Gail. And then it's good we have so many questions.
So we know that the literature and the users are moving to a virtual environment. In your shops, do you feel, where do you fall in the spectrum? Are you clinging to the old ways? Are you reacting to the changes? Or are you on the forefront of leadership?
Is it a question for John?
I think it's for both of us. Clinging to the old ways. I guess I could answer that with just saying yes. I don't feel that the library is necessarily clinging to the old ways. I think the library is reacting to what's going on in the world, but also reacting and analyzing and understanding what people at the moment are looking for, and people at the moment want. So there are, there are people, the computer scientists were in the total e-environment years ago. But we still have other people who are not there yet. So we've got to be all of those things, I think, mm-hmm. at least in collection development.
Mm-hmm. I would say yes as well. However, with technical services, I just said, you have to squat between, and people, users, and other units within the library want the process to be predictable, want the output in library technical services to be predictable, despite the shift over to data, over to E. And the challenge really for Jim, me, and all the directors in the technical services that has perhaps the largest staff body in the library, we have 70-some people, is how to gradually transition the allocation of staff to more e-based services and processes, but how to provide adequate skills training. You cannot say, do this, read law-like licenses. So those are very, but I think it's inevitable that we transition that way. But I also realize it is the library technical services will really process very traditional materials for a long time, because there are many, many countries that is not yet that advanced. But it is a knowledge that the university cannot live without.
Now it's my turn. I'm just wondering what's happening with web archiving.
With web archiving? Well, right now, my understanding is we've pretty much crawled the Cornell web. There were a lot of problems in the beginning because there's a lot of big stuff there and stuff that we didn't necessarily want. And that's been done by folks in RMC. And Liz Mueller has basically worked with Ken Williams. Ken did the actual crawling, and Liz, I guess, did some analysis and correcting and looking at things. And it's pretty much been done. What I'm looking for now is, in fact, I was just talking to our colleagues at Columbia to see how they have their system set up. They have a person who was a cataloger, who was funded initially on a grant to become the person who operated the crawls. In fact, his name is Alex Thurman, and he's the person that I worked with when we crawled some sites here. They did some sites for us. And basically, he's the technician who runs the crawls. But the selectors down there are the ones who select the sites to be crawled. And so that's the system we need to set up here. But we need to find the support for the crawling aspect of things, which requires, you know, a set of skills that need to be learned, I think. That's where that's at. Hopefully more soon, you know, to bring it out beyond RMC, because it needs to happen, I think.
So another question from the online submissions. What do you find particularly challenging in your role as AUL?
For me, there are good days and bad days. Good days, I can flow from technical services, all of a sudden dealing with a Sun article or dealing with a map or something that communications, and then move back to look at data. Bad days, it is so hard because the day is broken into pieces, and I just showed the four functions, they are not fluid. So you almost feel like a radio dial right now for this hour. You're looking at metadata, what to do with the staffing, how to shift, what about linked data? Is Cornell contributing to the universal linked data, revealing our bibliographic records? And then all of a sudden, something needs to happen in communication. You kind of switched abruptly to a totally different thinking mode. That is challenging some days. And you get good at it because you compartmentalize. I can picture my brain be sliced into compartments, like right now think here, but all of a sudden think here. So.
A big challenge for me is, I think, keeping on top of everything. There's so much going on. And email is a big challenge. I often prefer to talk to people on the phone. Mm-hmm. But then what I found out is that I don't have a record of what we agreed upon. And so it's gone from the memory if you don't write it down. So there's that problem. So there's a lot of things going on. Another big challenge is being able to keep up with any kind of reading. Mm-hmm. Because, again, there's a lot of things that come across all the time.
Absolutely.
And, I think the other big challenge is satisfying demands of people you really respect and enjoy working with, and you know you don't either have the resources or the talent, or something to give back to that, you know. And that's a challenge.
thanks. So I guess just kind of following up on that, I feel at my level, sometimes I can't keep up with email and professional reading, so I can't imagine how that's exacerbated by all of the different things that you manage and that you're in charge of. So do you, I guess my question is, do you look to yourself to kind of make changes to find that time for reflection and writing, or do you feel that the organization should help you kind of carve that time out? So I'm just wondering if it's sort of a personal choice or more of an organizational model.
For me, it's both. And I mean, having really, really incredible people like Kaiser and Jesse and, you know, everybody else we work with. I mean, all the support that Juju's office gives us in terms of fundraising issues, or when the sun calls and it's like, oh my God, you're going to be quoted. It's like, what am I going to say?
You know? Yeah.
And,
yeah,
it's, I think at any level we're all pretty stressed with a lot of things, you know.
I would say to me it's organizational and personal too. One thing I feel very good about is Shuja and Jim, if there are things when we realize, we're almost like in the unspoken pact, when there are things that will take many, many messages, Shuja shows up in my office and say, let's sit down and talk, because there were literally days I send the team a message to say, today, need this. And so she shows up, and that is one way. I feel that's a way to address the problem, which is it's really an organizational problem, that we spend more time in meetings feeling we are talking in effect when we have to have a lot of conversation to get things resolved. So Jim does that too. I will walk and say, can I have 2 minutes? And then we reach. That saves like 7 messages. Another thing that I try to do is I block my calendar and make it blocked. Nobody sees what it is, because I need to read, or else I'm making decisions on the fly, and I'm an introvert, I'm not good at it. So I block it and make it some red color, and then people will say, whoa, this must be something important. Yes, it is important, because I'm working, so.
Yeah, I mean, at my level of experience, that, you know, we're really lucky here at Cornell, because we have so many experts to rely on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for anybody at any level. So, you know, I think the most important thing is to get to know as many people as you can, and realize that I think everybody's here to help everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jesse,
run away.
I thought he was going to appear from behind the column.
I know.
So continuing on a theme, what types of things do you dread in your position?
God. I dread budget cut. I do. And I think for us, we are a very respected library in North America and in the world. I think we need resources to do innovative things. When you have budget cuts, you not only have to keep the work going, minimize the damage that user would see, but also find ways to invest in new emerging needs. And it's always a very, very hard position to be in, very difficult position or decision to make. And I can speak for all of the AOLs, or I believe including Anne, none of us like it. We agonize over little things and see whether there's any way we could avoid. Another thing that I said a little bit is I dread taking on tasks that is very time sensitive, that has to be done immediately, when I know I don't have enough time to think it through. I worry about this kind of thing, because many things, if you had a day to think about it, you may reach a different conclusion, because during that day, when I say think, it's not just me sitting in the office, I come out to talk to experts and say what to do with this. But if you are on the fly, and these are the things I dread, because I often wonder, could I have made a better decision? could I have made a different decision? And these are the things we all try, at least on the LiveExec level. We are trying to reduce the meetings and reduce those things so that we could make more thinking time, thinking, group thinking, so that we make a decision. We don't want people to say, I've never heard of that. And it's decided. Sometimes we don't have that time. Our job is like, we're paid to make decisions when some of the decisions are like that, and we have to accept it. But I do dread as a human being.
Yeah, I think I've been living with the dread since the budget cut, not enough resources dread since about 1978 when I first got involved with collection development. And you realize that, oh, we don't really have enough resources to go around, especially in the sciences. In the late 70s was when the cereals crisis, I think, really reared its head. And you know, walking into a faculty member's office and saying, oh, here's a list of cereals that we have to talk about. You know, that was a kind of a dreadful experience originally for me. And budget cuts have been, especially the last few years, have been really tough. But I think the thing I most dread the most is individual things, is disappointing somebody I work with, either by my own failings in that regard, not knowing something, or not being able to support them in the way that they, you know, that they would like me to.
I actually have a question.
I was a little worried that maybe this was too personal, but you did show a baby picture. So if you're willing, would both of you or either of you be willing to give a little kind of history of the trajectory of how you became to be an AUL and things that you felt might have helped you along that path? Was it your idea to become an AUL?
Not my idea. I didn't even know I would become a librarian. I'm one of the people that in our profession there's an accidental librarian notion. I mentioned my major was German, and I loved teaching, and my dream was to become a college German teacher. And I went to Germany, and due to circumstances, I never decided to live abroad, but I did, and I followed to my the husband to the U.S. And then I never realized I would come to U.S. And then who would hire a Chinese to teach German? So there goes my dream. So at the time, this was in the late 80s. You are not like smart kids like today. You can do the online searching, do your personality test, and then you figured you are a designer or something. And my husband was a postdoc at Yale at the time. We don't have any money, and I just said, oh, I can go to the Southern Connecticut State University. They have a library and information science major. I pay in-state tuition, which is cheaper than Columbia was about to close its library program. And I figured wherever there are books, there will be German, and somehow it will be used. So that's how I became a librarian. I somehow advanced. I never thought I would become assistant head of acquisitions and other things. Along the way, I did copy cataloging, I did acquisitions, I was a searcher in collection development, and so on. And I somehow got promoted into different level, and each time I figured, all right, why not? And it sounds like a challenge I could handle. And that's how I became the AOL today. But along the way, I really loved everything I did, and I feel very privileged to have worked in great institutions like Yale and like great institutions like Cornell, being exposed to collection development and copy cataloging and preservation, filed cards, dealt with art and architecture professors who had paint on their thing and pounded on the table and said, my student said, they can't find my must read when I was a circulation weekend supervisor. And so these exposure made me understand what I don't want to do to my staff. And it also gave me broad enough a background to say, oh, maybe I can handle this. So that's how I really find myself as an accident AOL than a real purposeful one. But it's the truth.
My turn. So I'll skip everything until about 1973. So I'll date myself. So I came here in 1973, and I have a bachelor's degree in engineering, and a master's in library science. And came here in 73, and my first job was as a reference librarian, and I love being a reference librarian. I've met some of my best friends through the reference desk. It was great being a reference librarian in the 70s because everybody came and asked you questions. You got, there was no virtual presence. There were no computers. In fact, my first part of my in the engineering library, you also did everything. Steve knows all this kind of stuff. But when you worked in the unit libraries, then you did everything. And so what I had to do was first I had to file cards above the rod. Mm-hmm. Now, how many people know what I'm talking about? Oh, really?
Love them.
Okay. And then when you learn, then when your supervisor figures out that you know the rules well enough, you get to the students file above the rod, and then you get to pull the rod.
Yeah.
And then it's
that's
power. It was real power.
Yeah.
But as time went on, I got involved with collection development in the engineering library, and then. And met some really incredible scholar librarians like Hank Edelman, who was the associate university librarian for collection development at the time. He was pretty much incredible. I remember the meetings we used to go. They were sort of like CD exec meetings, but we'd talk about things that people would bring in serial. The serials unit would bring in paper serials, and we'd decide, whether we were going to subscribe to them. And then Ross Atkinson was hired in 1980, I think it was. And so working for Ross for 20 some years was just an incredible experience. I mean, he was someone that I never felt I could copy, live up to, and I don't even try because it's Ross was, just an incredible person.
Yeah.
But so over time, I think I'm an accidental AUL too.
Well.
Yeah, right. In some ways, I mean, my background for the longest time has been in collection development, so that put that forward. But, yeah.
I just since you mentioned Ross, I wanted to share this. I think yes, I am accidentally somehow promoted into the position. I had wonderful mentors in my career, and Ross was one of them.
Right.
And many of the new ones may not know who Ross even is. And I remember I became the director, and I was in Ross's office in 201 one day, and just said, I need to talk to you. And I spilled out what I was facing. And Ross looked at it, and I told many of the people this story. He looked at me, and this is how Ross is, said, Shane, your director, your job is not to be loved. Forget it, people will like you or not. Your job is to make that decision. I know it's tough. What do you expect? Your soul? That sometimes he is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the type of mentor who shaped who I am. And from that day, there were times he still says, your job is not to be loved. But that's so true, because you are supposed to make those decisions. And I walked out feeling so grateful, because he could have said to me, oh, you're doing well, you're new to your director, this is awful, do this. He didn't tell me anything to do. He just said, you cannot expect to be loved. Just do this job. And I miss him.
Okay, here's a shift in questions. How can we be helpful and supportive?
Tell me what I do wrong and bad. Speak to me. No, there are times I run around. And personally, I think my best help is throw out ideas and tell me, Shane, are you really sure you want to do that? And because there a lot of things when you are doing it, you know, we have limitations. We are subjective, and everyone is. And I really rely on people I work with within my own little organization or not to tell me things that I ought to look into. That is the greatest help, and I've always had that. I'm lucky, but I hope I will continue to get that, because the wisdom is not in me, but in you. I feel that's why I don't want to leave Cornell, because of you.
Yeah, I would say communicate and challenge. I mean,
I think
Ross was, I don't know, in my growing up at Cornell, was one of the people who solicited that challenge. There were other AULs that you know, you didn't challenge them at all, or do much mm-hmm. communicating with them. But I think Ross put that forward, and you know, I really need that from people, because mm-hmm. I don't know everything, that's for sure.
And what would you say is the best way to give you either those helpful ideas or those challenges or the feedback? How do you best like to be that, you know, speaking of Sheen, you were talking about communication.
Mm. Talking. Yeah. If you feel comfortable, stop me anywhere and send me messages, call me. I prefer, if I have a choice, I prefer face-to-face, because you could be interactive, and sometimes you get a message and you don't even know what the context is. So I still prefer the face-to-face. I feel it is almost something that, as an organization, we ought to do better. Because there's so much more context that can be you can have than an email with three lines in a hurry, and I think we don't do enough. And therefore, personally, I would like to do more. And John and I, we say we don't want a cell phone so that we could just one finger do more. We'd rather spend the time speaking. And
yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, the best way I know to get to know people is to go for a run with them at noontime. But I also, you know, Leah Sola calls me up every once in a while and says, "Hey, let's go for a walk." So we have a meeting walk, you know, which it's really nice. I think, but as Sheen says, anyway, the only thing I don't do is. So I prefer the personal stuff and face-to-face stuff. The only thing, and Facebook's okay, but Twitter, I just can't figure out Twitter.
I don't want to be Twittered either. Right. But
I have an account, but I've never looked at it.
Yeah. No, John puts me to shame. He talks about walking. I eat with people. And when many of you saw me having lunch with different unit library directors, and I want to mention when I was at Yale, I worked at 4 unit libraries, so I get a sense of what you mentioned. You do a lot more things than in a central office. I don't run and I don't exercise with people. I eat with people. I eat with Bana. I'm now going to have coffee with Eric, because these are the people I no longer sit in meeting with. If I could, like I started meeting with Leah and Steve, but if I can't, I have lunch, because people eat. You talk about life. We have to know each other as human beings before we know each other's job. And the job is only a very small portion in the real life, and many people have challenges, and how to fit that together as a holistic approach is very important to me. So instead of running or exercise, I eat with people.
So the last question I have is one that John and Sheen did not see ahead of time. Oh. But it's one of the ones that we asked the students last when the Library Forum did the student panel. And what we asked them, so I'm going to throw this to you guys, is if there's and it sounds a bit like a Miss America question, but if there's one thing you could change about the library, what would it be?
About the library?
Yep.
Not having as many meetings.
Okay.
Have more time having personal conversations. That's definitely what I would like to see. Is that what the students?
They have more time than they realize. They're always like, I don't have any time. And I'm like, it's because they're on Facebook. Yeah. John, how about you?
I think I'd like to see the library appreciated more by the faculty across campus. I think it varies in disciplines, and I think there's some places where the librarians are much more peers and integrated and stuff like that. And I'd like, you know, I'm not saying that I want us to have faculty status, you know, where we have tenure and all that kind of stuff. But if I could change it, I think I'd change the university culture in some ways, where librarians had a more equal status.
Yeah.
Because I mean, you know, back to the running thing, I run with a lot of faculty members, and you get to know them on a personal level, and then all of a sudden that status is there, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. with most people. Yeah. But with people that you don't have personal experiences with, it's oftentimes not there.
It's true. Yeah. And I also eat with faculty. And that's how I find out what their view is about Johnson School, because I'm an alum, what their view is about hotel and about IOR, and think for communications, think for decision making. I actually ate with them last night.
Mm-hmm. I know when I first came to Ithaca, I stumbled into a poker group that actually included several faculty members from Cal's departments. And I was mentioning this to Kathy Chang, and she says, oh, you have to keep going to that. That's outreach. You have to.
It is outreach. Yeah.
And then the whole thing dissolved. One of the faculty members was Alan Matthews, who's now the dean of human ecology. But when he got appointed dean, it changed the whole dynamic, and the poker group just dissolved. It was like he couldn't come anymore, because but for a while there, it was good outreach. Well, do we have any other questions? Otherwise, I think we can thank John and Sheen for their openness to answer questions and tell us a lot about what they do and where they've come from and how they ended up being where they are. So thank you very much. Just a quick reminder that round two will be on November 5th with Oya and Dean.